So we're on to Psalm 86. Just preparing you for the psalm. The psalmist is singing of a tender devotion to God and his trust in God's kindness. Chesed is the word, so kindness, steadfast love. It's translated in a number of ways. God's already saved him from death. You'll see that when we come to verse 13. So he's obviously been very sick, or for some reason death was staring him in the face. He's been saved from that. And now it says he's asking God for another sign of God's favour. Seven times, we'll see, seven being very symbolic number, of course. And you know why, I hope. Do you? Seven? Yeah. Yes, it's to do with the lunar circle, you know, the 7 days from the beginning to half moon, full moon, half moon, new moon. So that's the basis of it. Seven times he calls God Lord, and the Hebrew is Adonai, which I've got the Hebrew there for you and the English spelling. Four times he calls Yahweh, Yahweh, and there's the consonants of Yahweh. For your information, which you may have heard before, in later times, late Judaism, still pre-Christian, but late Judaism, and then in the Christian time, the practice arose of never pronouncing Yahweh, because it was the Lord's name, and the second commandment is, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, name of Yahweh in vain. So rather than take the risk of taking it in vain, they never took it, basically. So they used to replace, and if you look at a Hebrew Bible, you'll still see a little asterisk and a footnote. Whenever you actually read with your eyes the tetragrammaton, the four-letter word, which is what it is, Yahweh, they would say at the bottom, read, meaning speak, Adonai. So that was the practice later. Obviously not at this time, because this psalm has both quite there. It may fascinate you or interest you that because of the way Hebrew Bibles were presented, and because that was there, and underneath had this, Adonai, that's the origin of the mistake of calling God Jehovah. If you take the consonants of Yahweh and put the vowels here, you get Yahovah. Yahovah. They misread it. They thought that meant you took the vowels of Adonai and that was how you pronounced Yahweh. So it's just a misunderstanding that's continued because of practice, Jehovah Witnesses and so on. But the pronunciation of that four-letter word looks much more like it would have been Yahweh. Now, the title of this, I don't do this with you normally because it's a bit erudite and a little bit difficult to understand, really, and even make sense of it for anybody. The Psalms often have a title. And the title of this particular Psalm says, A Prayer of David. Why am I telling you that? Because at the end of Psalm 72 it said, the prayers of David are ended. Now, in the whole of Book 3, which we're completing today, which is not, it's only 73 to 89, this is the only psalm that mentions a psalm of David, which throws us back to the question, what did they mean at the end of Psalm 72 when they said the psalms of David are ended? And no one's quite sure. Okay? So with that small introduction, let's enjoy the prayer of the psalm. Listen closely to me, Yahweh. Answer me, for I am poor and needy. Words that common, so common in the Bible. I am poor and needy. Please don't think of poor in the Bible, either the Old Testament or the New Testament, in the term that will rush straight to your mind today, because we have a money economy. They didn't. There was money, but not much of it, and most people could live all their life without any of it. They had their food locally. There wasn't a lot of starvation. There wasn't big populations, and there was enough usually to eat. So starvation was not a problem. Poor meant oppressed, for whatever reason it might be. And that's not because of lack of money. It's probably because you've been dispossessed off your land and you can't, how can you grow vegetables and that if you haven't got any land? So whatever it was, it meant we're the oppressed ones. And that could be a whole lot of reasons. The early death of a husband and no one to work to do the, whatever it was that they were going to buy barter, you know, exchange, all that stuff. So the poor and needy are those who are on the lower rungs of the social bracket, the most oppressed and needy, but they're ones who cry out to God, and God is the God who hears the cry of the poor. So here, I'm poor and needy, I'm crying to you, O God, so listen closely to me, he says. Preserve my being, for I am devoted to you. Save your servant who trusts in you. It's another aspect of the poor. They trust in Yahweh. You could be oppressed in the Bible and not be one of the poor, because poor already includes in it someone who is lowly and who cries out to God. It's got to have that little bit in. So when Jesus says, blessed are the poor, he's not saying it's great to be economically deprived. He's saying there's a blessing for those who are poor and are crying out to God, and the blessing is in fact revealed in Jesus in the Christian community. And you know, the early community shared everything in common. You know, there'd be no poverty really, because need would be the kind of thing Karl Marx, if he had known more about, may have embraced with all his heart, because he hated the world he was in, and rightly. We would have had to have been on his side in that argument. The dreadful stuff, as you know, going along at the time of the Industrial Revolution, all that. So he passionately fought against that, but he didn't know Jesus or what Christianity could have been, and the Christians who were part of all that system hadn't seen the point either. There was a lot of Christian. So being a Christian is a long journey for all of us. Preserve my being. I'm devoted to you. Save your servant who trusts in you. You are my God. It's a very personal psalm. Be gracious to me. Be gracious always means do little things for me. You know, grace always means 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 little things that happen daily to where God blesses us. Be gracious to me, O Lord, for to you I cry all day long. Gladden the soul of your servant, for to you I lift up my soul. Soul, psyche, being, mind, heart, you know. Because soul is actually not a Hebrew concept. It's very hard to translate. Soul was a Greek concept because of this pretty bad dichotomy they had in the Platonic world. You may know a bit about Platonic. So the real world was the realm of ideas, and what we see is kind of the ephemeral passing expressions of it. But the real, so you're really your soul, and your soul is trapped in a body, you know, a physical thing, but you're your soul in a way. It's too complex to put that simply. But the Hebrews didn't have that. You were just a human being, a living human being, or a not living. And if you're living, well, then your life force, your élan vital, is your soul. Gladden the soul, for to you I lift up my soul. For you, O Lord, are good and forgiving, abounding in kindness to all who call on you. Bringing in the idea of forgiveness as well. So he's not claiming innocence, but he knows God is the one who forgives. Listen, Yahweh. Listen, Yahweh, to my prayer. Attend to my cry of supplication. In the day of my trouble, I call on you, for you answer me. There's none like you among the gods. You're back into that polytheistic world. O Lord, nor are there any deeds like yours. And as a reflection on that faith, look at Exodus 15:11. Who is like you, Yahweh, among the gods? Here it is again. Who is like you, majestic in holiness, awesome in splendor, and doing wonders? And Psalm 89, which we'll look at later this morning, Who in the skies can be compared to Yahweh? Who among the heavenly beings? Heavenly beings is a nice way of, it's really gods, the sons of the gods. Who in, among them is like Yahweh, a God feared in the council of the holy ones, great and awesome above all that are around him? Obviously, picking up the idea that you've expressed in the Greek world of Zeus, or in the Semite world of El, or in the different worlds, you know, with their high god and their lower gods. And Deuteronomy, what god in heaven or on earth can perform deeds and mighty acts like yours? And our psalm continues, verse 9, all the nations that you have formed will come and bow down before you, O Lord, and glorify your name. I can easily imagine that verse of the psalm attracting Paul of Tarsus, you know, when he saw that Judaism at its best could be actually taken to the whole world as long as you cut out its legalistic stuff that kept it bound into a national group. But if you opened up the vision of Abraham being the father of many nations and that there is only one God, and it hit Paul so clearly. That was his conversion, change of mind. And then, of course, this kind of verse feeds it, doesn't it? All the nations. So he'd go out to the Romans and the Greeks and the whatever with courage and the message of truth and love. You are great and do wondrous things. You alone are God. Really, you alone are God. Isaiah 37, similarly, Yahweh of hosts, God of Israel, who are enthroned above the cherubim, you are God, you alone. So now, Yahweh our God, save us from his hand, so that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that you alone are Yahweh. Did the author of that part of Isaiah, was he a monotheist? It sounds like it. Or is he saying, look, they all call themselves God, but when you really come down to it, you're the only one who's really God. So I think it could still be in that grey area between polytheism and a gradual movement towards real monotheism, which is a very rare insight anyhow. Psalm 83, verse 18, let them know that you alone, whose name is Yahweh, are the Most High over all the earth. And Nehemiah, Ezra said, you are Yahweh, you alone. Ezra's the priest who brought back the Torah from Babylon, 450 roughly, middle of the 5th century, and that's where Judaism really starts, as Judaism, as distinct from the religion of Israel, which Judah was a part of. Ezra said, you are Yahweh, you alone. You have made heaven, the heaven of the heavens, with all their host, the earth and all that is in it, the seas and all that is in them. To all of them you give life, and the host of heaven worships you. Praising God, now the psalmist says, teach me your way, Yahweh, that I may walk in your truth. It's a beautiful prayer. Teach me your way. The psalmist is confident that he will walk securely because of God's faithfulness to him. That's your truth. And he's praying that he will be faithful to God. Your truth, you're faithful to me. Teach me how to be faithful to you. That's what he's really praying in that prayer. Give me an undivided heart to revere your name. It's a lovely prayer again. Undivided heart. The English word simple, you probably know, simple and duplex, I suppose. Simple is like one strand and then you get two, it's twined, and double. So double-tongued or double-hearted, divided heart, all those phrases are for, it's the virtue of simplicity, which is straightforward truth. You are what you are, and there's no twists in it. Here, Jeremiah 32 similarly says, I will give them, God speaking, I will give them one heart and one way, that they may fear me for all time, for their own good and the good of their children after them." And Sirach, early second century BC, Book of Ecclesiasticus, sometimes called, chapter 1, verse 28, "Do not disobey the fear of the Lord. Do not approach him with a divided mind." "I will give thanks," verse 12, "I will give thanks to you, O Lord, my God." And every time you see Lord in my translation, it means Adonai, not Yahweh. "With all my heart, and I will glorify your name forever." Forever needs understanding in their world as olam. It doesn't mean eternal. It means kind of unlimited time, you might say. So not forever really, but all my life, something like that. "For great is your kindness towards me. You have delivered my soul from the depths of Sheol." That's where we know that he's been saved from death. "You've delivered my life from the depths of Sheol. O God, the insolent rise up against me. A band of ruffians seek my life with no thought of you." That's the presenting problem. That's what the psalm's all about. Verse 14. A new problem's arise for him. "A band of ruffians seeks my life and they've got no thought of you. But you," verse 15, "O God, O Lord, are a God." And then we find the creedal formula that you find all through the Bible. The most classical text is Exodus 34:6, when Moses goes onto the rock and he wants to see the face of God, and God says, "Well, come out onto the rock and I'll pass by," but that God covers his face, because he says you cannot see the face of God. And then God goes past, saying these words, and then when he's gone past, the hand falls away, and Moses sees not the face of God, but the way God has gone. In other words, the Torah, how to follow God, how to see the back of God. But you can't see the face. So it's quite a nice image. But at least you know which way to go. The Torah. How to obey God, listen to God, and finally be in communion with God. Well, that phrase, or that beautiful expression in Exodus 34:6, when God goes by and says, "Yahweh, Yahweh, a God tenderly compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in kindness and faithfulness." Here it is here in Psalm 86, verse 15. And you find it also in the book of Joel, Job, another three psalms, which we'll do later, and the book of Nehemiah. It constantly recurs as a creedal. Therefore, you know you're in touch with not just another insight, but a key insight of the religion of Israel into God, and a beautiful one. So having said that of God, and that's their creed, verse 16, "Turn to me, be gracious to me, give me your strength. Give your strength to your servant. Save the child of your serving girl." So my mum really loves you, and she was terrific, and she was at mass every day, kind of thing, equivalent. So I'm her child, so, you know, look after me too. "Show me a sign of your favour, so that those who hate me may see it and be put to shame, because you, Yahweh, help me and comfort me." I think it's a nice psalm, a simple prayer. There's a lot in it, and it's all very, I suppose, beautiful, and we could all pray it.